Well, hello everybody and welcome. You have tuned in to episode number 367 of the most terrific amateur radio podcast on the internet. This is Linux in the Ham Shack, and we are doing our short topic episodes for tonight. And those short topics cover a wide variety of things tonight. So we should probably just dive right into it. I'm Russ, K5TUX.
I'm Cheryl, W5MOO.
And I'm Bill, NE4RD.
All right, so we have a lead topic. I'm going to try and make this lead topic very short. Well, let's just say that there's a certain member of the IRLP team. We'll call him the head guy. I'm pretty sure he's like the creator. I imagine he's not the only one that had anything to do with the creation of IRLP, but obviously he's the big dude. And I had, I think I've talked on this program, or at least in the Discord, about setting up a portable IRLP node and all that, getting all that stuff set up and how much I was enjoying using IRLP. And then I switched over, because I still had the node, but then I switched over to All-Star, and I included my Echolink and my IRLP in with my All-Star, because since you can run all this stuff together, why not, right? Consolidates it, allows you to link the three systems together. Seems like a cool thing to be able to do. And that was working great until sometime last week when all of a sudden I no longer had access to the IRLP network and I couldn't figure it out. So I emailed them and I said, hey, I can no longer get on the IRLP network. And they said, oh, well, Ham VoIP is not a legitimate way to get on the IRLP network. And we pulled your keys and so long. So.
Okay.
So, well, they didn't say so long. But I told them so long, because if you're going to be that political about it and, you know, that oligarchical about a linked network system, when there are other, and as far as I can tell, better linked repeater systems in the world that don't have these particular issues, then I don't need to be a part of yours. And, it just so happens that most of the repeaters in the world that are linked to IRLP are also linked to All-Star. So I figure I haven't lost anything except dealing with IRLP. So,
wow.
I know there are, you can do point-to-point communications pretty easy with IRLP, seemingly easier than with, well, no, I take that back. I mean, it's just as easy with any of the All-Star, the Echolink, or the IRLP. And for the most part, from what I've seen, if you're using one, you're probably using more than one. So, you know, if I want to get in contact with somebody, I'll just use Echolink or IRLP. I mean, Echolink seems to have much wider adoption anyway, since IRLP tethers their licensing system to the purchase of hardware, which is already kind of a painful thing.
Yeah.
So, but I'm not going to do ad hominems. I'm not going to disparage anyone. I'm just going to, I don't know, lightly suggest that if you're getting into this repeater linking system or, you know, digital networked radio communication, pick one of the other systems. Don't use IRLP.
There's a strong endorsement. Anything but, right?
Yeah. I mean, All-Star is so nice, especially the way they have it set up at Ham VoIP. hamvoip.com org net. I think they all work. And like I said, All-Star systems seem to be connected to as many systems as IRLP is, if not more. And there are no politics involved that I can see. And the software is open source and it runs on open source hardware. And, you know, so just go that route. And, with the N8AR devices, the kits for Ham's Place, where you can get, you know, you can get online on All-Star for about the same, maybe a little less than you pay for a proprietary IRLP board, which doesn't even include a radio. Kind of seems like a no-brainer. I kind of wanted to be a part of all the networks, IRLP included, but I'm not getting involved in this kind of hassle. So,
yeah, that's not a very neighborly way to treat anybody in the community.
It's not. And I'm still trying to figure out how they knew I switched from the actual node to Ham VoIP. I'm not sure how they figured out I did that.
Spyware.
Yeah, I mean, there must be something about it. Some part of the actual IRLP operating system that reports something back that HamVoIP doesn't. But if you want to have an interesting read, check out, do a Google search for HamVoIP and IRLP. And you'll have a long, interesting email conversation thread that'll make you smile probably for a half hour. all about the politics of IRLP. So anyway, that's all I wanted to say about that. Just thought it should be brought out. And since I have a voice that reaches more people than Cheryl sitting across from me.
Yeah, at least five or six.
Yeah, at least six or seven people heard this.
So. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So we're good. You got the world covered.
All right. Anyway, moving on from the lead topic, and let's get into some amateur radio stuff. And Bill's got all kinds of things in here to talk about. So let's do it.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, we have the big one that's been making the rounds, the Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, FCC 20-116. Yeah, so unless you've been living under a rock, you've heard of the possibility of a $50 FCC licensing fee for the amateur radio service. Oh, my God. So, yeah, I was just reading the notice that went out here, and let me just give you some copy of it. In this Notice of Proposed Rulemaking notice, I'm not sure why that's twice. We seek comment on the new application fee schedule proposing significant changes to the commission's existing fee schedule in both types of applications and other processes covered by the fee requirement and also in the amount of fees proposed. The new fee schedule and proposed fees impact stakeholders in every industry overseen by the commission. The new and revised fees policy fees apply to a broad spectrum of filings processed by the commission, including applications, modifications, and renewals of wireless television and satellite licenses, applications to participate in auctions, to tariff filings, formal complaints, and certain petitions. As we explain below, the changes we may initiate today derive from the modification to the commission's submission statutory application fee authority made by the Ray Baums Act of 2018. Very scary stuff. So anyway, everybody was asked to make comment and propose comments and stuff like that. And of course, you know how that works. It's all blind comments, except for you can see how many people actually leave comments on it. And I was trying to dig into this a little bit further. And I started looking at the Ray Baum Act, which if you don't know what that is, this is important because it's called the Repack Airwaves Yielding Better Access for Users of Modern Services Act of 2018. It's very wordy, so that's why they made it Ray Baum.
Ray is the bomb.
Yeah, and I was kind of digging through it, and I'm still not seeing where they can do the $50 fee in any circumstance. Period. There's two sections in the act that kind of talk about these items. One is the amount, the dollar amount. And they have it specified in section 2, the threshold for adjustment. And it says the commission may not adjust the fee under paragraph 1 if, in the case of the fee, the current amount, which is less than $200, the adjustment would result in a change in the current amount of less than $10. So I don't see, we can't have changes more than $10.
you're assuming people are going to read the rules.
Yeah, so it's like, well, okay, I could see how they could possibly charge 10 or something like that, and the same thing, if the fee's over 200, they can't change the fee for more than, or amount less than 5%. So, well, I guess, amount less than $10. So I guess maybe it could be 50. But if you go down into the exceptions, which is section D, part 1, section C or whatever, subsection C, the exemptions to this are specifically outlined as a non-commercial radio station or a non-commercial television station. And I'm pretty certain that's exactly what the amateur radio service is non-commercial. And we're defined as such by Part 97.
Yeah, I kind of thought that was the whole point of the amateur radio service, was that it was non-commercial.
Yeah, I mean, I know that the idea is they think that this over-encompassing thing that says, yeah, we have to start charging everybody for everything. But it's pretty clear that it's not specifically applicable. And this includes application fees, where we're specifically excluded. A non-commercial radio station is excluded. And regulatory fees as well. They are specifically excluded, not only as a non-commercial radio station, but also specifically as an amateur radio operator licensed under Part 97. So we are not applicable to fees of any regulatory fee. So we can't get charged for any regulatory fee. An application fee, I would still think that we would fall under a non-commercial radio station. But we're not a broadcast, so that might be loosey-goosey there. But they also say that you can't – the exceptions also include nonprofit entity licenses, so we know what that is, or special emergency radio services. So that sort of founds, again, kind of like
the amateur service. Yeah.
And I'm not sure why we weren't specifically excluded in this particular section here in the application fees, which might be the way that they think that they can go ahead and charge us money. I have to say I'm not really terribly against it, but I think it's a bit much. I mean, obviously they haven't changed the licensing fees. The fee schedule hasn't changed. What did I write there? 30 years or something like that? Yeah, the current application fee framework was established more than 30 years ago by Congress. So it hasn't been changed in a long time, and this seems like a pretty drastic change, and specifically affecting the amateur service, which is not a commercial radio service. And it also provides emergency services and public service. So it seems to me that, you know, just in the wording of the Raybom Act, that, you know, we would be most likely excluded. So if they were to institute any fees, I would think a legal case would probably have to be brought by like the ARRL or something like that to get that decision reversed and get the language amended to ensure that the amateur radio service is excluded from any fee collection. I think that'd be a way easier battle than the PRB one or whatever that they spent so much money on and couldn't succeed through Congress in the last few sessions that they tried.
Yeah. So like you, I'm not necessarily against the fee either. I think, it's not prohibitive, but I mean, if it goes against the guidelines for actually establishing a fee, I mean, obviously, you have to abide by that. So,
yeah, I would say there's probably enough meat in the Raybom Act that, you know, a decent case could probably be brought forth. And, obviously, the cost of litigation is not worth the $50 collection fee on renewals.
Right. Absolutely.
not at the cost for those DC attorneys to operate. So,
all right. Well, let's not get too buried down in that. I guess we'll see where it goes. I'm sure the ARRL will be on top of it if it comes to a head. And I'm sure since you've found these points in the Raybom Act that they're aware of them as well. And we'll deal with the litigation accordingly. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, they have made a decision, so it's not like it's there, but like I would think that in people's discussions on the request for proposed action, they would probably mention some of this. It would probably be useful information.
Maybe they just floated it out so they get a whole bunch of new hams.
Yeah.
Not gonna. I don't think the FCC really gives a crap about how many hams there are. So yeah. All right. Well, moving on from Raybom and $50 application and renewal fees for licenses here in the good old U.S. of A., let's talk about a project from Andy, G7UHN. And Bill, I'll let you go ahead and take this one, too, since you threw it in here.
Yeah, I saw this, and I was thinking about putting this in the LHS area, but I was kind of short on amateur radio stories, so I thought this was kind of a cool little project he worked on here. This is the FT-817 companion display and controls, and I'm assuming that you could probably get this to work on the 8818 as well. But you probably want to check out the website. But yeah, Andy's project has been making the rounds. He's been on Hackaday and the SWLING blog. SWLING blog? I don't know what you're going to call it.
Swing.
Anyway. Yeah. So, he finally has an article on his own website. And where he writes, I like spending time with my FT817ND in the great outdoors. But it always seems like the Yaesu's choices of functions on the ABC buttons has me fiddling around all day on that tiny front panel. When I want to lower the power for a tune signal or raise the power back up for a QSO, switch the CW filter in and out, use the AB, which is your VFOs, and the A equals B keys to help me browse around the bands. I just need a couple more buttons, don't we all? So I started thinking about adding a small control panel that could be programmed to send a couple of commands to the radio via the cat port, maybe with a little display alongside with some new buttons, effectively adding some new soft keys. Now, that thought quickly led me to KA7OEI's amazing work in documenting the FT817 serial command interface. And it wasn't long before I was reading the FT817's frequency on a small OLED that was lying around the workshop. I then realized the utility of including some of the front panel information in a display that can be more easily read than the radio's front panel with the rig. When the rig is on the ground, my normal /P operating position. So a bit of breadboard prototyping and a couple of KiCad tutorials later, and voila. So yeah, within the link in the show note, you can go check it out. You probably have already seen this on Hackaday or possibly SWLing, but if you haven't, check it out. It's a cool little display, and obviously soft buttons to do exactly what he said. And he's got a big to-do list there as well of things he's thinking of adding to this project. But on his site, he has all the resources and everything else, including, let's see, what does he got here? He's got a bill of materials, the PCB files, the Arduino code, and the tutorials he used actually to get to that point. So his to-do list includes a bunch of other little doodads, PCB rework and stuff like that. So yeah, it just definitely looks like a really cool project for those owners of those little 817s that are very popular and probably, like I said, the 818s are probably very similar in the cat control.
I know when this popped up in the Discord, several of the folks who were in there who apparently own FT817s were all on board with getting this thing set up. It looks like a pretty easy kit to put together. Or a project, because I mean, it's not put out as a kit, at least not yet. But it looked like it's going to have some pretty significant uptake. And as it gets better, I'm sure there'll be more out there.
Yeah. And of course, you know, Andy's a listener of the program here and is also in the Discord quite often. And that's where we heard from it first.
It's always kinda, nice. Yes.
Yeah. It's kind of rolling around in my head. I was like, I know I saw that somewhere. And of course, it was right on Hackaday and everywhere else. So yeah, great job, Andy, and getting the word out on that. And you know, now it's even here. So we have talked about it as well.
All right, very cool. Well, that's all we've got in our straight up amateur radio topics for tonight, but we're going to roll steadily and swiftly on into open source. And I threw a couple of stories in here that were interesting. The third one, pay attention if you're in the Discord for the third story, because we might have a little bit of a discussion about the third one. So, So anyway, the first one is a pretty straightforward story. We've mentioned Huawei many, many times. And I know Bill and I had a discussion earlier about, is that how you pronounce that? And I'm like, I don't know. That's what I'm going with. So...
Yes, it's that Huawei.
Yeah, Huawei. You know, the one that everyone wants to banway?
Yeah.
Or Anbei? Yeah, that one. swing the Huawei Anbei Amerhei.
Yeah, we prefer Cisco's NSA backdoors to China's Huawei backdoors.
Exactly. And speaking of backdoors, Huawei officially launched the Hongmong OS 2.0 system at the HDC Developers Conference. Today, the system released the developer beta version for large screens, watches, and cars. That's what we want. We want Huawei systems in our cars. The company also said that it will release the mobile version in December. After the launch, smartphones will fully support the Hongmong 2.0. And this is open source, by the way. That's why we're talking about it. In addition, the official website of Huawei Harmony OS is now online, and the source code is available for download. The global version of Huawei Hongmeng OS is Harmony OS. And I've got a link from this story, which was on Giz China. So I don't know if that's like Gizmodo for China.
Or yeah, it could be.
Something you're not supposed to feed after midnight, or I don't know. Anyway. but I also have a link to the download site if you actually want to get the code. So there you go.
Oh, that's cool. They released the code earlier than was thought, because I thought they had originally thought that the code would come out in October. So that's really cool.
Yeah. So, I mean, a month early, I guess. If people are interested in this, check it out. You know where to go. All right. The second story. Cheryl, you want to read a story?
Sure.
Oh, wow. You said yes. I can't believe it. You don't normally say yes.
Okay, I'll say.
Are you not Facebooking?
No.
Oh, good. Well, you can read the second story then.
Been shopping on Amazon.
Okay, maybe you should just go back to Facebook.
Yeah, back on Facebook. Back on Facebook. Need to uninstall an Amazon app quick. Yeah. Yeah. Check the credit cards up quicker.
I've been getting a lot of use out of Amazon myself lately, so it's okay. All right.
Yeah, I'm spending all your money.
Okay, that's good because I'm spending yours. So I guess we're
all right. Yep. All righty then. So our next story is Square fights patent trolls on killing Bitcoin adoption. American financial services firm Square has been a major proponent of cryptocurrency, from its Cash App being a popular place to buy Bitcoin to its Square Crypto division, awarding several grants to developers of free open source projects. Today, Square Crypto unveiled its next step in its push for the continued growth and well-being of the industry, launching the Cryptocurrency Open Patent Alliance, or COPA. COPA continues to focus on open-source technologies that Square Crypto started with its grants, but broadens its horizons by inviting other crypto industry companies to join. To do so, companies must pledge to never assert patents on what Square calls foundation cryptocurrency technology, quote unquote, unless it's to defend those technologies. Furthermore, members will contribute to a shared patent library that allows fellow members the ability to use those patents defensively against outside patent trolls, which Square says will give even small companies a shield to protect themselves against patent aggressors. And the source for this came from decrypt.co.
Yes, I thought that was interesting. We routinely talk about cryptocurrency and blockchain and things like that on this program. And if you're a small business owner, you probably use Square right now. And Square, I didn't realize, was heavily invested in cryptocurrency. So this is kind of cool. And any story that talks about dealing with patent trolls, I'm definitely into. So... So take that for what you will. If you don't use cryptocurrency, then you don't have to worry about it.
Yeah, one Bitcoin is worth 10 grand right now. 10,439.
Yeah, so you can mine your 0.00001 Bitcoins with your high-powered multi-GPU computers. All right. Anyway, moving on to the controversial story. We'll see if anybody has anything to say about this after I get done reading it. I cut it down as much as I could. There's a lot more to this in the actual article. But it goes, why Linux needs a flagship distribution. In a recent podcast from Noah Chalia, co-host of Destination Linux, he says you can go to a Best Buy and purchase a computer, but depending on who made that computer, when that computer was made, what software is available at the time, it all affects the quality and the experience you get as an end user. That struck me hard. And the me in this case, the I, is the author of the article, not Noah. It also made me realize that it needs to be said again, Linux needs a flagship distribution. Imagine you're a third-party software company and you want to port your number one selling title to Linux. What desktop do you port to? What package manager? Do you develop with Snap, Flatpak, AppImage? What about the kernel? The challenges are many. Now imagine a single distribution has been chosen from the hundreds of currently available distributions to represent Linux to hardware manufacturers, vendors, and software companies. That one Linux distribution would be used by hardware manufacturers and software companies to create computers and software guaranteed to run on Linux. The distribution would have only one desktop environment, one package manager, one init system, and the current stable version of the Linux kernel. Users could also download this Linux distribution and use it at will, but the primary purpose would be to make things easier for manufacturers and developers. I realize this is a big ask. Every time I've ever broached the subject, I am pummeled from all sides with pushback about how the greatest thing going for Linux is choice. Choice is part of what brought me to Linux in the first place, but that doesn't mean I want to foist that choice onto consumers who've never used or even heard of Linux. Given that's the audience we should be focusing on at the moment, a flagship Linux is long overdue. This is what Linux needs. It's what will help make mass acceptance a possibility. And that came from Tech Republic.
Oh, yeah, it sounds like it would come from them.
No,
absolutely not. I mean, you know, this is like so deep. You know, why can't we have a flagship computer making company that makes a computer that doesn't suck, so we don't have to have so many stupid choices of really crappy underpowered hardware versus like high end gaming hardware? Why does it that, you know, AMD graphics cards go bad fast because they're crappy, but like you got to buy the latest Nvidia one for $800 so you can play a game that runs at 5 FPS on your Intel graphics card because Intel makes the processor. Yeah, I mean, you know, we got bigger fish to fry than which damn Linux distribution to have. I mean, if you really look at, if you want to call everybody else's flagship distribution a flagship distribution, I mean, Mac OS would be the purest one because they actually control the hardware. But like, if you look at all the installs that all the various manufacturers do of, like, let's say, I don't know, Windows 10, with all the bullcrap bloatware that they throw on there to support their hardware and some of their custom drivers and all this other bullcrap that they throw on there that makes Windows 10 a very bad experience in the most part for people on these various systems. I mean, you can find, go through Amazon. We just talked about, go through Amazon. Just start looking at reviews for any computer, an Asus, you know, pick of the break, big brands, Asus, Lenovo, Acer. they all have problems. Even Dell has problems. You know, a lot of people, you know, hate the stupid Dell support app that comes up and, you know, does driver checks and stuff like that because it conflicts with what Intel says your computer needs. And this is in Windows 10, a flagship distribution. So it's all bullcrap. You know, the nice part about Linux is that you could actually develop your Linux install to be specifically optimized for every bit of the hardware that's in there. You know, if a flagship distribution is to have a fat kernel that's overly compiled with stuff in there that you don't have in your computer just so it supports it, that's not, I mean, nobody wants that. I mean, those are your, you know, typical, I don't want to say it, but Ubuntu users and stuff like that. It's already built in there. I mean, go look how big the kernel file is. Go look what the kernel settings are. Go in and try to compile your kernel and see all the checkboxes that are checked on that you don't need for your piece of hardware. That's all bloat.
When was the last time you actually tuned a kernel?
Not in a long time.
Yeah, exactly. That's why somebody came up with the modular kernel architecture, because everyone decided they didn't want to tune kernels anymore.
Yeah. I mean, you know, but that's nice. That's a nice part about it, right? Because you put it on a flash drive, everything comes up, you know, you have all the kernel modules now that just kind of pop on when you need them, but like your base level stuff's kind of already in there. Otherwise, you know, yeah, 90% of the computers would wig out. Right. But yeah, I don't see it, because like a flavor is the game, and they do it with Windows 10 as well. I mean, everybody's Windows 10's a little different. Go buy five different laptops from five different vendors. Guaranteed the startup process is slightly different, and all of the stuff that's running on the computer already is slightly different. Even probably with the same hardware, it's going to be all slightly different because the vendors do crap that they shouldn't be doing.
So you don't see any case for one distribution that developers develop to, and that people who want choice can go do whatever they want to do, but they can be assured that if a software package is released, that it will run on this particular distro.
What I would like, and I think most people would maybe like it, I don't know,
is the issue we're trying to always solve is the software that gets installed afterwards.
Right. We're talking about the distribution, not the Linux kernel part. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about basically the app center, how we get apps on there and is that app up to date? Is it the latest, greatest? Is it, you know, can I go right to, you know, wherever I got my app from and get the latest version? Is it easy to install? Is there maintainability with that?
But the thing is, like, that sort of architecture with like snaps and flat packs, the problem with that is you have the same issue that you had with these programs that were developed for Java that had to be packaged with their entire runtime environment to get them to work. So you have to do the same thing. Unless there's some way to get a thinner abstraction of these snaps and stuff. Yeah.
I would say that the performance difference on a snap versus native is probably not that big a difference. Neither is flatback or app image.
Throwing resources at it just because computers are stupid fast anymore. That's no excuse things in a dumb way.
Well, I mean, have you seen a website lately?
I was telling you today when I was trying to cut and paste that article that there were 6 paragraphs of text and 400 pages of CSS.
Yeah, and 5,000 pages of ads over their TechCrunch's website and stuff like that. I see the desire to maybe have like the enterprise solution for it. I mean, we do have enterprise solutions for Linux. I mean, companies offer that, like, Ubuntu or Red Hat. You know, they both have enterprise solutions. Your big distributions, your flagship distributions are there, whether or not they have adoption. You know, I mean, Dell installs Ubuntu on their computers and ships them out. Lenovo installs Fedora on their computers and ships them out. System 76 only installs Linux on their computers and it's Pop OS and ships them out.
So there's your flagship distro right there. Pop OS on System 76. Go get it.
Yeah. I mean, but like, there's people that don't like GNOME, like me. You know, I appreciate everything they do over there at System 76. They make really cool looking computers and there's a lot of good engineering that goes into those designs and stuff like that. And Pop OS is great. But like, yeah, I hate GNOME and, you know, you're not going to get anybody that likes Linux, it likes Linux for very specific reasons and it's not to be pushed into a single box.
Right. And I think that's why this article sort of unchecks that box and talks about pushing Linux on people who don't necessarily like it or use it. And
that's what Chrome OS does, right? So we already have the ubiquitous flagship distribution that gets shipped out on $200 laptops all the time.
I suppose, but no one's going to start coding to Chrome OS.
Yeah, they do all the time. Have you seen a website lately?
Well, okay. Web app is not what I'm talking about.
Progressive web app? Are you kidding me? What's driving a lot of your phone apps and everything else and things you use? That Amazon app is a progressive web app you're using on your iPhone.
I don't see GT5 as a web app.
Well, it'd be an awesome web app. Go, like, you know, run over some hookers and stuff like that. And
yeah. You heard it here first. GTA 5 is a web app. So
yeah, that'd be awesome. Way better than Fortnite as a web app. Come on, you know, or not Fortnite? Is it Fortnite?
Yeah, Fortnite.
So, like Don says, CentOS, another enterprise. Now, I don't know if flagship is equating to enterprise distribution.
I don't think so. I think it's a different mindset behind this concept of a flagship distro. It's sort of like the one distro to rule them all, in the sense that if somebody creates an application that runs on Linux, it will run on this distribution. And that doesn't necessarily have the same space as an enterprise Linux, because there's a whole lot of crap that doesn't run on enterprise Linux.
Well, I mean, if we go and we just beat all these distributions down to their core systems, I mean, you know, seriously, what do you have? Debian, you know, Debian powers just about, I don't know, powers Ubuntu and everything else, Mint, a bunch of other little, you know, boutique OSs all ride on top of, you know, either Ubuntu, who rides on top of Debian, or, you know, whatever. So, I mean, it's Debian. And then you have,
the Fedora, which is all Red Hat.
Yeah. Right.
And you have that split is what OpenSUSE and, just Red Hat, I guess, and stuff like that. CentOS. there's not very many, like when you break them down to their core functions and pieces and stuff like that. Yeah, there are very many choices along all those different paths. But, I don't know. I mean, I like distro hopping. It's so much fun because I like get tired of Ubuntu after a while, and I like going to Fedora, or I like going to Solus, Solus, and I can't wait for Serpent OS to come out as well. So like that'll be my next boutique OS to jump onto.
Well, you might want to read this whole article then, because the author is also a big distro hopper, and so maybe reading the whole thing might put it in some different context. But anyway, good discussion.
Cool.
So, yeah, like I said, that came from Tech Republic. Link will be in the show notes. And now let's move on to Linux in the Ham Shack. And Bill is going to tell us about Raspberry Pis for ham radio. This sounds like good stuff here.
Yeah, this is really good. This was also featured on Hackaday. This is Raspberry Pi for ham radio via Anthony, F4GOH, or KF4GOH, blog. And he says, since 2012, the Raspberry Pi Nano computer has become an increasingly important part of the DIY and maker community. The increase in power of the Raspberry Pi over the years offers very interesting possibilities for radio amateurs. Indeed, it allows not to permanently monopolize on a PC in the decoding of frames with software like WSJTX, FLDigi, etc., without forgetting the possibility to control the Raspberry Pi remotely, and thus being able to work outside the Radio Shack, as I can sometimes do on my couch. Moreover, this nano computer is now widely used in any hotspot, like DMR or D-Star, and we've talked about that as well. And on the blog here, he's got tutorials, a 7-part PDF that's specifically designed for beginners wishing to acquire the basics in the installation of the Raspberry Pi through the use of radio software. And he goes into separate sections here, and one is a Raspbian operating system with the graphic interface, and how to prepare it, how to get the IP address, how to access your Raspberry Pi remotely via PuTTY, WinSCP, and VNC, and all that good stuff, back up your MSD card, as well as connecting your transceiver to the Raspberry Pi, doing sound management, CAT system interface management, radio software installation like FLDigi, WSJTX, JTDX, JS8 call grid tracker, CQR log, my favorite, QSS TV, and GPredict, GQRX installation, RTL SDR key installation, and how to listen to HF and VHF with GQRX, FT8 coding with GQRX and WSJTX, and first steps with GNU radio. So a lot of good stuff in there. He also has operating the Raspbian Lite operating system without a GUI and how to get that configured, basic commands and file access rights, and doing Whisper. And also, he has a section on installing and using OpenWebRx, which, of course, we've talked about in the past as well, which is a cool little web-driven SDR application for your SDR. So, yeah, go over and check his blog out, Ham Projects blog. It was linked as well over on Hackaday. And, obviously, we talk about the Raspberry Pi so often. It is the ubiquitous computer everywhere. If you haven't got a Pi yet, go buy one. And then start looking at, getting it set up to do some stuff. And I guess the real reason why I did that, because I also wanted to mention that I haven't started playing with it yet, but I did download the RigPi software. And like I mentioned to the guys in the chat room, when I found out, you can just go to MFJ and pay $30 and download the software. And if you already have your Raspberry Pi 3, you can just load all that stuff that's pre-installed and ready to go and get your little RigPi going with all your own connecting devices. Like I already have a ham key here, and I have a USB hit win key, and I have a the good old sound box, the Tigertronics signal link. So I have everything I need to get it going, and I hopefully will have that ready and running by the time we have our deep dive on remote ham radio. So
there's an easy way to get into it. You don't have to buy the $250 or $290 box, whatever it is, with all the cables and stuff like that. If you're like me, already have like all the parts, you can do it for $29.95.
Very cool. So while you're in the process of talking about the rig pie, deconstructed rig pie.
Yes.
We can talk about some new releases from over in the FL, the Fastlight Toolkit application space.
Yeah, we got a couple. Basically, these are flash topics. I just want to mention, if you're not on the Linux Ham mailing list, you might want to just join it just to kind of track some stuff going on over there. The developer of the FL products, like FL Digi, FL Message, Rig, Arc, all the FL products, David, W1HKJ. He's always releasing random stuff over there or random releases, versions and stuff like that. So, these are two things he's posted, just in the past week. FL Message 4.017 is released. This is a maintenance release. This fixes a seg fault on the send bug, test for empty string and the ARQ log, and it fixes a bunch of memory leaks he found in the source code. So, check that out if you, use FL Message for anything. FL Rig, he has an alpha out for that. He changed to a memory dialog user interface. Oh, he changed the memory dialog user interface. He made it have larger font, header line for the browser. A comment size was increased to 255 characters, and it has a resizable dialog. And that's kind of a cool little quickie interface for, like, if you got, you know, want your rig set up for doing a net or something like that, you can just double click it, or I don't know, I can't remember, it's right click or something like that, and it automatically just, you know, changes your rig right to that setting, for so you don't have to have memories in your radio itself. You can actually just have memories in your FL rig control, and it'll just go right there. And of course, you can swap off obviously between rigs and still have those shared memories and stuff like that if you have multiple HF rigs or what have you plugged in there. But that's available out there now. So that's 1.3.5.1.17. Oh, that's a whole mouthful of semantic versioning there. So yeah, check out the Linux Ham mailing list. A couple of links to those emails are listed there, so you can check those out.
All right, very cool. And I'm still waiting for the next release of WSJTX because I want all that cool stuff they talked about. So I don't know if it's the development cycle that's really slow or anything. Do they have an alpha channel somewhere? I don't.
They don't share that. They used to have that. That in the PPA and Launchpad, but they've since then they're no longer developing against that, so they don't push any builds out there, at least not that I've seen, or nobody's maintaining it.
All right, well, come on, WSJTX, where's 2.3? I want it.
Yeah, I'm sure it's getting close because they've been talking about it a lot. That's also a mailing list. If you're not already on it, you know, you can definitely join it and do a lot of watching.
Yeah, I've been on the WSJTX one. You said the other one was Linux Ham. I think I'm on that one too. I don't ever pay attention to it. I got to start doing that. All right. So that means we have come down, sadly, to the end of our topics for this episode of the program. But that means we have arrived at the social media roundup, and we want to make sure we mention all the folks who are supporting the program in one way or another. We can't obviously list all of the listeners. We'd be here all night. And also, we don't know who they are. But if you're a supporter of the program, we're gonna enumerate you now, and also let you know who's recently come on board via our social media platforms. Okay, is that
done? Nope. Wow, it's gonna work again.
It's gonna work. Yep.
Technology.
He always gives me the crappy stuff.
It sucks. Yeah. So. It's my mantra. Technology sucks. I'm going to get it like tattooed on my forearm.
Or your forehead. Or whatever.
Forehead. Face tattoos are just a no.
I told you about the guy.
Yeah. So. We know. Anyway, social media roundup.
All right. So let's get on with it. So this time for our Patreons, we have Richard Gordon, Andy Webster, Cubicle Nate, Darren King, David Jakeway, Donald Gever, Douglas Rutter, Erna Gustalis, Herb Garcia, John Spriggs, Peter Caffrey, Paul Griffith, Randolph Smith, Robert Pitt, Samuel Vimes, Steve Metcalf, Steve Sainer, William Heckelman, and Jonas Rulo. For subscriptions, we have Howard Dittmer, which is new. Yay. We have Mark Farrell, A. Taylor, Peter Spotts, Robert Black, Randolph Smith, Robert Halliday, James Lewis, Fred Cole, Michael Burdack, Alan Wilson, Ronald Icke, Michael Connelly, Steve Biella, Jim McKenzie, Dylan Engel, Johnny Kinsey, Robert Yerke, Bill Pioter, Darren King, Thor Wiegman, Todd Bowers, Kevin Ivey, John Clark, Bill Collins, Jeff Zimmerman, Tony Coberly, Roger Pereira, Jeffrey Boris, Michael Carey, Steve Hepler, and Michael Jopling. We have Eric Nelson on Facebook. On Twitter, we have at L. Llanos at Ed2DBJ, or excuse me, DJB, at Dub Hologram, at Ham Chat Forum, at VA3VGR, at KD8JBV, JBG.
Oh, we're going to have that problem.
Yeah, we're going to have this issue this week. Yeah,
what was it that I couldn't get last time?
I don't remember what it was, but yeah, you tried through
Hotel times. Bravo Foxtrot, Brown Sugar Dewsbury.
Yeah.
Bacon Sugar Dewsbury.
And at Y08TNB. For YouTube, we have Matt Young, Denton Larson, Barry Benikoff, and Lino Casu. On the mailing list, we have Howard Dittmer. And that's it. There were no merchandise sales.
There were no merchandise sales. And all the merchandise sales that we had have been shipped out, so everybody should have those, I would think, by now.
Oh, yeah, because they went out last week, right?
Yes, I think so.
Yeah, it was last week, yeah. So.
Yeah, so everybody should have whatever they ordered. So thanks to all of those orders from before. Thanks to everybody who listens to the program. And thank you to everybody who was in the chat room tonight. We should probably let people know who those folks were. We had Tony K4XSS, Ed N2XDD, Don KC9ZMY, Don KB2YSI, Don, and Don, Ted WA0EIR, and Gene BX8AAD. And we haven't seen Tom N4HAI in a while, so we haven't been able to do the thing.
Yay.
Aww.
Yeah, I know. It's sad. Well, maybe he'll show up here. Well, we did switch dates, so maybe Thursdays are bad for Tom. I don't know. We'll see. Anyway, thanks once again for listening. We really appreciate it. This has been the Short Topic episode number 367 of Linux in the Ham Shack. I am Russ, K5TUX.
I'm Cheryl, W5MOO.
And I'm Bill, NE4RD73.